Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. If you thought the assassination of the Russian ambassador to Turkey might be a kind of Archduke Ferdinand moment that turns the Syrian civil war into a regional international one, think again. Turkey has been turning toward Russia, not away from it this year, even as they are technically on opposite sides of the Syrian civil war. And yesterday, the day after the assassination, in a stunning announcement that Russia calls the Moscow Declaration, Russia, Turkey, and Iran stated that they will seek to end the war, or at least establish a meaningful ceasefire. The U.S. and the U.N. were not invited to the table. Let's start there with our first guest today, David Filipov, Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post. We'll also touch on the confused moment regarding Russia in this country, with Congress and the intelligence agencies investigating Russian hacks during the election campaign, but the incoming Trump administration denying they were involved. David, thanks for coming on with us. Hello from New York.
Thanks for having me.
The Moscow Declaration for an expanded ceasefire that Russia, Turkey, and Iran would guarantee. Do Russia, Turkey, and Iran have enough power over the various sides to do that?
Well, I mean, they have as much influence as anyone. Russia, of course, is been supporting Bashar Assad. Turkey has a lot of influence with some of the rebel forces. And, of course, the larger picture here is that we can do something that the United States has been unable to do. And that part is true.
You wrote that Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov hailed the new talks with a dig at the United States. I have a 16-second clip of him. Tell me if this is what you were referring to.
Your Excellencies, dear friends, colleagues, we convene in the format of three foreign ministers, Islamic Republic of Iran, Republic of Turkey, and the Russian Federation.
Was that basically it, the simple exclusion of the United States?
Well, that I think the exact words he used, we can finally overcome this stagnation that has characterized peace talks until now. And, you know, Lavrov has said on a few occasions, this is a waste of time when we get together with the United States. So from Russia's point of view, just the very fact that you're bringing two regional powers together, including Turkey, which has, you know, for the longest time opposed Assad. Now you're able to bring Turkey together with Iran and create this powerful regional force, subtext at the exclusion of the United States.
John Kerry must be bursting out of his suit upon hearing that, because I think he feels that he's been trying to get Lavrov and his boss Putin to go along with a meaningful ceasefire time after time after time, and then they say yes, and then they walk away, and it doesn't really happen. Is it going to be any different without the United States, or does Russia just get the sort of propaganda points of excluding the United States?
Well, I mean, if that's a great question, obviously, and it's going to be hard for me to answer it completely, since we don't know what Assad is going to do, do we? You know, Turkey and Russia made a kind of a deal on, you know, the ceasefire in Aleppo. If they can build on that, then they can make some meaningful progress. The idea that you're going to expand that, though, so that all the opposition groups who are not affiliated with the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda or whatever are going to get together with Assad. Assad stays in power. There's going to be some power-sharing agreement. That's, you know, that's something that is a long time off.
I haven't seen a reaction from the Obama administration or the Donald Trump team to these talks. Are they reacting in any way you've seen?
I think that the Secretary of State has called, you know, Lavrov to extend his condolences about the ambassador. You know, Donald Trump has condemned the terrorist attacks around the world. I don't believe that they think that there's any point in giving it the significance that it purports to have by making mention of it. From the American point of view, sure, let them have this little, you know, talk, but what are they going to really accomplish? I'm guessing that that might be one of the reasons. Now, the other thing is that when they made this statement, the Moscow Declaration also includes a line that says any other parties who are interested in forging peace are welcome to join us. Huh. But the idea is that we're at the front. The Troika, as Lavrov called it, we're at the front of this. And, you know, that's, you know, kind of more of a symbolic statement than anything else. Yeah. And symbolically, the United States can extend its condolences for the ambassador, which is the right thing to do, while tacitly, you know, holding off on what this tripartite group can do. Because right now they've issued a declaration. They haven't yet tried to do something on the ground.
Maybe it's a good thing, the exclusion of the United States. I mean, I realize you're, you know, the Moscow bureau chief for the Washington Post. You're not an opinion columnist, but
– nope.
Both the progressive left in this country and the America First right want to see the U.S. scale back its role as policeman of the world and encourage countries in different regions to solve their own problems without our blood or treasure. I keep seeing on cable television here this morning America, you know, American talking heads lamenting the fact that this reflects that America is weak. But that makes it sound like it's about power for power's sake. Can you describe, as a reporter, any substantive potential impact on the United States of these peace talks going forth without the United States, if in fact they bring peace?
Well, and also let's consider the I'm tacitly going along with what you're saying long enough to say let's also consider the context. We're an outgoing administration. We're, you know, a country that has fought in the Middle East and Central Asia now for 15 years. But more importantly, look at what actually took place in Ankara. A guy waved a pistol, said, "Don't forget Aleppo," and shot the ambassador 8 times. He wasn't a terrorist trying to just shoot as many people as he wanted to. This was a political assassination, and the reason of the assassination, according to the person who did the gunfire, was Russia's role in Aleppo. We as a country are tired of that. I'm not an opinion columnist. I'm talking about, you know, what Americans say. Uh-huh. They're tired of being the country that is, you know, that is at the end of that anger. And Russia is not talking about that now. Russia is talking about its nascent alliance with Turkey and, you know, the ability to bring Iran and Turkey together. They're not talking right now so much about the fact that this attack appeared to be in retaliation to the very, very strong military role. And I think that the United States, people are tired of that. The larger picture is if you're the United States and you're trying to create a world in which, you know, freedom, democracy is the system that everybody plays for, then somebody like Bashar al-Assad is your enemy, right? But what has our, you know, long-term involvement in the Middle East brought about? And this is something that Putin plays upon all the time. And I'm sure that, you know, now I'm going off the reservation here, but when Americans heard about possible Russian involvement in the American election, when Hillary Clinton talked about that, and people didn't run out into the street protesting it, and half the voters, like they usually did, didn't show up, and Trump won anyway, I think part of that is that a lot of people don't care if Russia is influential in our elections. And maybe they even see something to the fact that Putin says, why are we trying to fight these despots? Let's keep them in power and not have crazy revolutions. Yeah. Maybe there's something to all that.
Listeners, we can take your phone calls for David Filipov. He's the Washington Post Moscow bureau chief. And with all of this going on with respect to Syria and the assassination of the Russian ambassador in Turkey, as well as the post-election context of the investigations into Russian hacking and the political responses to it. Anything you want to ask David Filipov in Moscow, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or just share your thoughts, 212-433-WNYC. Let's talk more about the assassination. The assassin who killed the Russian ambassador to Turkey on Monday did so right in broad daylight, on camera, wearing a suit and tie during a ceremonial event in an art gallery. It was very surreal. And as you said, he shouted, "Don't forget Aleppo, don't forget Syria." How much do you know who the gunman was and if he represented anyone besides himself?
Well, you know, there's talk in Russia and in Turkey. They have a group now of detectives from Russia, and they're working together with Turkish investigators. They've yet to make any conclusion. In Russia, the talk among various foreign policy types is that he was somehow related to Jabhat al-Nusra, which is one of the al-Qaeda-affiliated groups fighting in Serbia, in Syria. In Turkey, there was a lot of talk. Some of the reporting that we had from one of our reporters, Adam Entes, about the possibility that he was allied with the Gulen movement. That's a movement that Turkey's government accused of being behind the July coup attempt. And you'll remember that this Gulen is a cleric who lives in Pennsylvania. So the speculation has been those two completely different things. In Russia, you also hear that this is the hand of foreign security services who are trying to destabilize the effort between Russia and Turkey to forge, you know, a friendship. That it wouldn't be Russia without that. In Turkey, you also hear that there's a bigger plot here, and that there, you know, Putin today said that Russia's going to get behind the fact who the people that, you know, ordered this. There is no acceptance right now on either side that this is a lone wolf.
As you wrote in the Washington Post today, for most of the Syrian civil war, Turkey's President Erdogan was the Syrian rebels' most vocal advocate. But he's been softening that stance as his country warms to Russia. Most of our listeners are just going to get confused, or at least starting out confused by the geopolitical intricacies of all of this. Why was Erdogan the rebels' most vocal advocate at first? And why has he been warming toward Russia?
Well, first of all, he needs friends. Second of all, have you seen on the ground who's winning in Syria and who's behind it all? You know, the idea that the opposition that Turkey backs is going to be able to overthrow Assad has gotten, you know, significantly less likely. The path to victory, as we say in the United States, is a lot narrower. And Russia has positioned itself as a broker, as a power player there. And they're also positioning themselves as the lead humanitarian aid provider and the country that's allowing civilians out of Aleppo and basically doing a lot of things that say, hey, join us. And here's Turkey that is looking for friends, and Erdogan, who had, you know, made his own accusations about who was behind the July coup attempt. It's a significant move, but it's a strategic move. And, you know, it's a move towards imagining the future now that overthrowing Bashar Assad isn't necessarily going to happen right away.
Another amazing thing is that it was just last year that Turkey shot down a Russian warplane that crossed from Syrian airspace into Turkish airspace, and it looked like Turkey and Russia could be on the brink of war. That was just last year, wasn't it?
And we were going to have President Hillary Clinton. You know, the world changes really quickly. But again, and by the way, the diplomat who was assassinated was the ambassador on the ground, and he obviously did a lot of work on that. One of the reasons why Russia is mourning the gentleman is because he was such an important player in those negotiations, according to what I hear here. I mean, I don't know that for a fact. I know that that's what they're saying. It was a huge crisis. It looked like it was going to be really bad. Putin and Erdogan saw the opportunity in it, and they overcame the need to respond.
Yeah.
And, you know, Putin's last year, his annual address was full of fire and brimstone for Turkey. And now that wasn't there, because the way that the world has gone for Putin this year, you know, things are shaping up pretty well. Friends are coming into power here and there, at least in the United States. The president-elect is saying positive things about Russia for now. You know, there isn't any need to have a confrontation with Turkey. And if Turkey can be an ally, at least a tactical one in Syria and maybe even a long-term one, well, hallelujah.
Fadi in Manhattan, originally from Syria. You're on WNYC with David Filipov, the Washington Post Moscow Bureau Chief. Hi, Fadi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I'm Syrian, and I have a family over there. Just recently, I came from Syria on October. I went to see my family. It's terrorists everywhere. And the media lie. They say moderate opposition. There's no opposition in Syria. They all run to Europe. The majority run to Europe, sir. And the revolution, what they say, we support a dictatorship in Saudi Arabia. Why we against in Syria? Do we learn from Libya? Do we learn from Iraq? Yemen, Saudi Arabia bombing Yemen every day on a daily basis. Is terrorists everywhere now all over the world? It's no good. And this guy who assassinated the ambassador related to Al-Qaeda because Erdogan government suspend him. That's what they say a couple months ago. So is why retaliation to the Russian ambassador? It is Al-Qaeda. This is linked to Al-Qaeda.
So if that's the case, Fadi, what would you like to see done by the United States or by whoever?
Yes, sir?
I'm sorry, maybe you couldn't hear the question.
Yes.
What would you like to see the United States or anyone else do for Syria?
The United States has done damage a lot. They supply weapons and taxpayer money to those rebels and those they call them moderate rebels. They're all terrorists. They're not supposed to involve in Syria or nowhere else.
So is Assad
so do what?
Better?
Assad, not better. Assad is good to the country. Assad, he was controlling the country. He will still continue to control the country because those rebels brainwashed. They are terrorists.
Even if the rebels are terrorists, wasn't Assad also responsible for genocide or near genocide after the original Arab Spring uprising in 2011?
No. The Arab Spring was made up.
Yes. So what you see having happened in Syria was all really terrorist groups trying to take over from Assad from the start, is the way you see it.
Yes, sir. That's what the plan, to overthrow the government, regime change. Why they helped the Bahraini when the uprising in Bahrain, when they came up, the people in the street, why they turn it off against the civilians?
Fadi, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. So, David Filipov, go ahead, enter anywhere.
When we look back, would Saddam Hussein, in the end of the day, would he have been that bad for us when you think of everything that it cost to get from there to here? I mean, you can say that, I suppose. And Fadi makes a very good point. You know, we support dictatorships whose policies are probably as at odds with our philosophy about how people should be allowed to live. And we don't fight them, Saudi Arabia. So the larger picture of why intervene here and not there, and what is the goal of that? That's definitely a question that Americans are asking, they should be asking, and it's going to be interesting to see how Donald Trump, who has raised the question in general, why are we getting involved in these things? It's interesting to see how he's going to respond to that.
Is it possible to say how much Fadi speaks for Syrians? Are Syrians broadly divided? I realize you're the Moscow bureau chief. You're not reporting
from Moscow. I got to say, I can talk to you about Russia's positions in Syria. I haven't been to Syria, so I can't say that.
Yeah.
I can tell you this. I mean, where have I been? I've been to Iraq. There were people who were treated horrendously under Saddam Hussein, and there was a country. Then there was a civil war, and then there was, more civil war and more unrest. if you took somebody today and said, well, what's better, what we have now or what there was in 2002, you know what I mean? It would be hard to find a majority who would say it's better now.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's what we've learned after this incredible odyssey of involvement, military involvement in the Middle East.
Which is why Obama has been as restrained militarily as he has been.
Which is why he's been as restrained as he has been. And when they look back at his presidency, you know, right now he takes a lot of hits for not acting decisively, whatever. But the restraint and the predictability, but also restraint, maybe one day when they look back at that, they're going to say, yeah, that's what this was all about. It was, hang on a second. You know, and I mean, I'm, again, veering away from my own area here as Moscow bureau chief. But the question that Fadi raises, which is, what goes into our calculation about whom to support and whom not to? When the Arab Spring started, it was like, look, there's democracy happening, just like it happened in the Baltics and just like it happened in the former Soviet Union. Just like, you know, here's more democracy. This is great.
And then we see what happened. So what here's happened. Another Syrian-American caller, Ghassan, who wants to pick up on what Fadi said. Ghassan, thank you so much for calling in. You're on WNYC.
Yeah, hi, Brian. I'm a Syrian American. I've been living in the States for about 20 years, but I still have extended family in Syria. And to me, what gets lost a lot in the media here is the one-sidedness of news reporting. You know, we get it, Assad, you know, isn't the West's cup of tea, but he, you know, the previous caller is correct. You know, Assad's son, who's the current president, you know, he's a Western-educated person. He's not as evil as he's made out to be. Now, I don't know if his officers behave differently, you know, when we've heard reports of weapons of chemical weapons, thank you, being released. But he was slowly opening the country to the West. The economy was improving. There were more liberties. Again, very, very slow, but it was happening. And, you know, people have been living kind of in the dark ages for a long time. When they have some sort of liberty, they don't really deal well with it. Now, from firsthand accounts of families that have lived in Aleppo, and, you know, I myself, I'm from Aleppo, and I used to visit until the uprising started. A lot of those demonstrations were propaganda. Some of them were fake demonstrations loaded up onto Facebook, and they took life of their own. You know, they became viral, or the West caught on to them. But there has always been a movement towards reconciliation. A lot of the uprising that's stated as a civil war is not really a civil war. It's more influence of external parties, namely Saudi Arabia, Qatar, you know, just because of the geopolitical stances in the region. You know, they're both against Iran because of the different sects in Islam. You know, it goes on and on, and it's very, very messy. But to kind of put it all at the feet of one person, I think, is oversimplifying things.
How much does it complicate the narrative that you just laid out, though, assuming all of that is true, that Assad reacted with the vast massacres of civilians that he reacted with, at least in the way you view him?
You have kind of, the way I see it, and this does not justify anybody's actions at this point, because it's kind of gone to the point of no return. He's backed into a corner. This individual is fighting for his life at this point, you know. You know, if you watch any of the interviews he's made, he's done with.
Whoops, did we lose you?
Did we lose him?
Ghassan, you there?
That's too bad.
Yeah, I guess we lost him.
We're getting a trend, aren't we? We get,
we are.
You know, I mean, and
well, it's a sample
again,
of it's a sample of two, but
sample of two. But they have family there, and they're saying that, you know, I mean, as two guys who aren't in Syria, you know, the Russian has been reporting a completely different story than the one you get in the American media. It's coming from the Russian military. There's no necessarily reason why any of that has to be 100% believed. But, it's been extremely hard for reporters to get in there. And reporters who have gotten in there have gotten themselves in a lot of trouble. I myself have been trying to get the Russians to take me in. Okay, tell me what's going on. Let's tell the American reader.
Into Syria.
Yeah. Take me in. Let me go with you guys. Show me what you're doing. It's not easy. I would have gone, months ago if I could have.
The courageous David Filipov, Moscow bureau chief of the Washington Post, with us.
It's more dangerous driving up and down, I-278 in Queens. I know that for a fact.
Dan and Ossining, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to take issue with, what David was saying earlier before, the suggestion that, the fact that a lot of voters, weren't protesting and didn't show up for Hillary in the election because voters were okay with Russians' involvement in the U.S. election. I think that's a big jump. Personally, I'm worried about the quality of information we're getting. And there's been a lot of talk about fake news and so on and so forth, but even from the mainstream media and from Hillary Clinton herself, for her to say, on a national, televised debate that, she knows for a fact that Russia, hacked into the DNC computers or what have you, I still don't know that we know that for a fact. What's the evidence? There's so much.
Well, we know that the CIA and the FBI and 15 other intelligence agencies agree that that was a fact. That's what we know.
Dan, you're not on the phone with the mainstream media. I'm one guy, and I said one thing, which is that those allegations did not make 75% of the American voters run to the poll to stop that from happening. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying people liked it or accepted it. I'm just saying when somebody said, hey, the Russians are trying to steal our elections, whether or not you or me believe that's true, that in itself was not the kind of rallying cry that made Americans go out and vote. That's all I'm saying. I think you can agree with it.
Right. Yeah. My comment, what I want to suggest too, and because there's a lot of talk about, what's coming out about, the Russian hacking and so on and so forth. It wasn't too long ago that, there was weapons of mass destruction in the United Nations and everyone was standing behind that, and no one really dug into the evidence.
Not me.
I
was in Iraq. Yeah, I was writing that there were no weapons of mass destruction. So
right. But I understand your point, Dan, that when Trump dismisses the CIA conclusions, maybe too flippantly, because they got the weapons of mass destruction wrong, that may be too flip, and that may ignore a million things that they've gotten right between then and now, but it does play into a distrust of the CIA that's legitimate and widespread on both the left and right. If they can blow the big one, then maybe they're blowing this big one too, right?
And I think that what Dan's saying is speaking for a lot of people who have lost trust in the things we used to accept wholeheartedly. You don't think you're getting the full story from us, the media. You don't think you're getting the full story from the CIA. And that's the real state of the United States of America right now, isn't it, Dan?
Yeah, I'm going to bring up, there was a piece by Samantha Bee, where she showed, Russian contractors – putting out tweets that were, maybe pro-Trump and anti-Hillary. Sure, I'll buy into that. But, when there's this, idea of this mass conspiracy to tip the election a certain way and even the fact that a candidate goes, tries to go that far to try to get voters out, yeah, you're right. It didn't work, but I'm not sure it worked for necessarily the reasons that, at least I thought you were implying. To me, it seemed like it didn't work.
All I'm saying is that they didn't, that there wasn't this, hey, everybody, let's run to the polls to stop those Russians from stealing the election. That did not take place.
I think it also matters that what they did, even though I would agree with people who say this was an act bordering on an act of cyber war against the United States and intended to disrupt our electoral system and probably intended to help get Donald Trump elected, that what they did was basically an act of garden variety opposition research. They hacked into the actual emails that Democratic Party officials and Clinton campaign officials were sending to each other and released them. That's fairly garden variety stuff. And so people, to the extent that they paid attention to the Podesta emails at all, which I actually don't think was that much compared to other things that were going on in the campaign, they saw things that that were real. If Russia had hacked the political system in other ways, like actually trying to affect the election machine, you know, the voting machines and change the votes and other things, then the country would have risen up as one, probably. But because of the nature of what they released and the fact that people felt, well, maybe they were learning some things, even if they weren't vital things from it, then I think that also tamped down the reaction. Dan, what do you get a reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm scared that, you know, I don't even think, you know, Russia was hacking the DNC emails. You know, based on what I know, it's most likely the NSA. And you know, the only evidence I see about Russia's involvement is you know, again, you know, they've got some kids on Twitter, you know, sort of elevating this you know, false narrative right. of all these people who are upset and so on and so forth.
Well, I don't think
That's not inconsequential, but that's obviously something we can deal with and address, and that's, you know, tangible, right. as opposed to this idea that, you know, there's this mysterious forces that we can't, you know, compete with.
I hear you, Dan. Although mm-hmm. I think that it's been pretty well established that there were two different things going on. One was these hacks, which probably did come from Russia with the intent of affecting the election. The other is the fake news, some of which, and David Filipov, you can comment on this as a Moscow bureau chief, some of which Russia might have been behind also, but some of which we know was being done by, you know, kids in Macedonia or wherever who discovered that by putting out fake pro-Trump stories that they could make money with, you know, sidebar ads.
Or fake, you know, fake anti-Clinton stories or whatever, you know. That and the two things go hand in hand. The fact that, you know, Dan and all the people who agree with him feel like when I speak, I'm lying on behalf of some great mainstream media conspiracy. And that, you know, when they see something in RT or Sputnik, that's just as, you know, it's got as much of a chance of being true as anything the Washington Post might write. That's the way it is right now. And, you know, the famous one is the pizzeria in D.C. that, you know, with that fake story about how it's a front for child pornography wing. And a guy went in there with a gun and started shooting because he was going to save the world from this thing that had been debunked already. And then the son of the future national security advisor is tweeting about it.
Right.
And everybody believes this thing. So now turn that around. Somebody's going to say, well, this whole thing about Russia hacking the election is fake news that somebody made up and turned it into this thing. And now the Obama administration, everybody's treating this rumor as the truth. And so in the environment we're in, half the people are going to believe that and half the people are going to believe the other thing. That's where we are now. There isn't this thing anymore where, hey, the Post had it. It was a well-researched story. It had all its facts straight. I guess that's the truth. You know, whether that was ever the case, it's definitely not now. But I will tell you one thing. Hillary Clinton made a political call. I am going to go out to the max with this Russia thing. I'm going to make it the thing. Donald Trump is working for the Russians. And I'll say it again. That didn't not only not work, that also kind of backfired because there she is screaming about some Russians and some Putin. And Trump says, Putin's not a bad leader. He's better than you. And that worked. That worked. Whatever Russians did and whatever Americans think about Russians, when you say, hey, the Russians are trying to steal the election and you're their puppet, and the guy's answer is Putin's not a bad leader, he's better than you, Americans choose the guy that said that. That's what it sounds like.
Right. Well, yeah. That conversation isn't over, right? There's going to be a congressional investigation, presumably, that's beyond the Clinton campaign, where they're going to determine how much Trump is puppet of Russia, if not a puppet, at least an ally. You're over there, so I don't know if you saw the Saturday Night Live Cold Open this weekend, which had, you know, Rex Tillerson as played by John Goodman and Trump as played by Alec Baldwin, but with Putin and Rex Tillerson kind of being buds and, you know, saying, oh, get away to Donald Trump. You know, maybe that's what's going to happen afterwards. In fact, as we run out of time, why don't you give us a little bit of intelligence on that kind of thing as the Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post? How much do you think that Putin and Trump will wind up on a collision course over something once Trump is actually inaugurated and Putin doesn't need him to get Clinton eliminated anymore?
Okay. First of all, I mean, Putin is a tactical thinker, and he's just thinking, I want somebody in there who's going to be more likely to go along with policies that suit me than Hillary Clinton would have been in. And, you know, whatever deals or whatever hacking or whatever went on with Trump, Putin is cynical and he's skeptical. And he, by the way, needs to lose about 30 pounds to look like the Saturday Night Live actor did.
Without a shirt.
Which, by the way, he could. You're the president of Russia. Get a trainer. Have a salad, for crying out loud. All right. You know, what do you know about Donald Trump? What do we know about him? Putin sends that aircraft carrier to the Mediterranean to make a statement. Donald Trump says, wait a minute, I got 11 carrier groups, and they're huge. You know, a Russian plane buzzes an American aircraft carrier. And Trump says, wait a minute. President Trump says, wait a minute. They can't do that. I got planes too. You know what I'm saying? What I worry about with Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin is you have two people who make a very big show out of public posturing.
Right.
You know, the anti-Obama, if you will. Obama is always in his public appearances trying to be stable, trying to be, you know, trying to portray dignified state,
right.
Whatever.
No drama Obama.
No drama Obama. And a lot of people have lacerated him for that. Fine. Putin also has a public persona that's tamped down, but his actions can be very aggressive, very assertive. Enter Donald Trump, President-elect Donald Trump, who will be in charge of the most powerful military force the world has ever known. And there are going to be confrontations, and there are going to be accidental this and accidental that. There was the shootdown of the Turkish jet, of the Russian jet by the Turks. Something like that happens. How is Donald Trump going to talk to Vladimir Putin, call up and say, hey, look, you guys help me out, so I'm not going to let this get to me? What in our history with Donald Trump suggests to us that his reaction to that kind of crisis? See, I'm not worried about Rex Tillerson because he's the major, you know, it's an oil major. Those guys deal with everybody. I'm not worried about Rex Tillerson, you know, selling the United States short. He's a master negotiator. He's going to push for his side, whatever his side is, and that will result in what it results in. What worries me is you have a force in Donald Trump that is unpredictable, and that is, you know, it's all about Donald Trump. And now he's going to be in charge of the world's most powerful military. And Vladimir Putin is not going to stop trying to portray Russia, to project power, to extend his boundaries, to send a military force into the Mediterranean, to project force in Syria. He's not going to stop doing that. So what's going to happen the first time that he wants to do something and Trump doesn't want him to?
That's the question. Stay tuned. It is not the end of history. Wow, we should do this more often. David Filipov, Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. I'm in the book, so give me a call.